I saw 100 men who had abused dozens of children. A fetus had been found from a little girl who had been just 13 when she was made pregnant. She had the mental capacity of a younger child. I would have punched somebody. I was incandescent with rage. I was angry. I was incredulous. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. There were 99% British Pakistani Muslim men. Nobody would speak about that. It was a very uncomfortable truth. I don't care if it's Jeffrey Epstein or Harvey Weinstein. If you cared about victims, you would not have allowed this to happen on your watch. It terrified me, actually.
You've saved their lives.
I was going to speak out. I was not going to be silenced.
Are there right now British Pakistani gangs exploiting children? Welcome to another episode of Heretics. They just come one after another, and today's episode is a doozy, as I think no one says. But it is an episode with Maggie Oliver, a former police officer who became very much embroiled, and she'll tell her story in the Rochdale grooming scandal. Grooming gangs, these were, as she goes on to explain, 99% British Pakistani men. Of course, not all British Pakistani men, not all of any group. Humans are humans, individuals are individuals, but cultures also heavily influence certain behaviours that are imported into Western countries. And she will explain a lot of that in a very impassioned, I was caught between the two, way. And she's just an absolute hero. She is incredible. So I'm so lucky I got to talk to her. I hope you guys find this interesting. She tried to lift the lid on all of this. There was a drama made about her called Three Girls, about what happened with the girls who were groomed, the children. It really is just horrifying, and the way that most of the police turned a blind eye. You can support her with her foundation, as she talks about. It's a link in the description as well. And I encourage you very much to do so. Follow her on all the socials and things like that. And please do share this podcast with everyone you know who you think would be interested in all these different kinds of heretics. But now you're listening to Heretics with Maggie Oliver. Tell me a little bit, just for those who don't know, about your backgrounds and the Rochdale gangs.
How long have you got?
We got an hour.
I just always describe myself as an ordinary woman. You know, I've got four kids. I was married. I joined the police when I was 41. So I was an older recruit, if you like. And I think that's probably what made me different, that I had a very, some would say, overdeveloped sense of what was right and what was wrong. But when I'd got a kind of a rich life before I joined the police. I travelled a lot. I went back to university when I was 37. I was quite confident, but I believed that when I joined the police, I was joining to make a difference, to do the right thing, to protect the vulnerable. And when every police officer swears an oath of attestation, and in that oath, you promise that you will uphold the law, that you will protect the vulnerable, you will do it to the best of your ability. And really, that's what I thought I was doing. And I was in the police for 16 years. And it was only really my first concerns were when I worked on a case in Manchester in 2004 and 5, where I saw 100 men who had abused dozens of children, that we knew their identities, their car registers, their phone numbers, and about three dozen children, most of those living in care homes, from the age of 11 up to about 15. And we had a big operation called Operation Augusta. I worked in it for about a year and a half, but my husband was terminally ill. And I went off work he died in July 2005. I went off maybe 6 weeks before he died. And when I came back to work after he died, that whole job had just been buried, completely died a death as though it had never existed. And I couldn't understand how that could happen. But I had no paperwork. I'd got, 4 young children, 2 still at school. I was in a mess. I'd been with my husband for 30 years. And so I tried to get answers, but I hit a brick wall, really. And uncomfortable as it was, there was little I could do because I didn't have any paperwork. I didn't have any evidence. The computer system had been closed down. So it was my voice against the machine, if you like. But I worked, I didn't work in child protection, Andrew. I worked in serious crime. I worked in the major incident team. So I went back to my normal duties. I worked on gang-related murders and shootings. I did kidnappings, witness protection. I loved my job and I was really good with vulnerable people. And so 5 years later, I was approached and asked to go on a job in Rochdale, which was identical to the job in Manchester in 2005. And the drama Three Girls kind of covers this a little bit, but I told them I wasn't interested. Yeah, I wasn't putting myself through that again where I...
That's the BBC drama for the, yeah, people the, outside of Britain. Might
sorry.
Not know it,
yeah, Three there was a BBC drama ultimately commissioned that we won 6 BAFTAs. I think it's back on iPlayer now. You can watch it again.
You were in it. You were played.
I was played by Leslie Sharp, yeah. And that... drama actually very clearly explains what child sexual exploitation is. It explains what grooming gangs do. What it didn't do was focus on the failures of the police, on the Crown Prosecution Service, on what I would consider corruption and gross criminal neglect within the agencies that are meant to protect children. So if I roll back to the start of that job, it became known as Operation Span, and I was asked to join it. Now, I was approached, and the first thing I was told was that there'd been a routine property review in Greater Manchester Police property system, and a fetus had been found. And that had been seized 2 years previously from a little girl who had been just 13 when she was made pregnant. She didn't know that the police had seized it. They'd never told her. They'd never told her mum. They'd not had any consent. And yet they knew that she was being sexually abused by a gang of men. They needed DNA from that to prove who had made her pregnant. So because of my skills with vulnerable people, I was asked to go on to that job to bring on board not only that little girl who was called Ruby, that's her alias, okay. That's what she was referred to in the drama, Three Girls. Would I approach Ruby and her family, tell them that we had a fetus, keep them on side and ask them, ask the family, could we, would they cooperate with an investigation and help us to prosecute the abusers? So that was a big ask because that family wouldn't even let a police officer through the door. And that was because 2 years previously, they had already spoken to the police and social services. They didn't know about the fetus being seized, but Ruby's sister was called Amber. And as a 14, 15-year-old child, she too had been horrendously abused. But then at the age of 15, she was accused of being some kind of a madam. And had been arrested. Nothing had come of it, but it had terrified her. And I was asked to also gain her trust and ask her whether she would support a police prosecution. So because of my experiences earlier, I was not prepared to go on that job. But I was given cast iron guarantees that if I brought these kids on board, that there would not be a repeat of Operation Augusta, that they would be supported right the way through to court, and that I would be allowed to support them. And alongside that, I was given official policy documents documenting those promises. In relation to Amber, also the top lawyer in the Crown Prosecution Service had assessed why she'd been arrested. It took 2 months, actually. And at the end of that period of time, he said she should never have been arrested. She is a victim in the same way as all the other children. And with those guarantees, I agreed to go on that job.
Is it worth mentioning at this point that I believe it was that these gangs were 99% British Pakistani?
Yeah, they were 99% British Pakistani Muslim men. There were one or two, like Afghanistani. But at that point in time, nobody would speak about that because it was a very uncomfortable truth. And I don't think we talk about it very much now, but I do think that there is an acceptance. I don't think it can be avoided anymore, that this particular kind of sexual crime, grooming gangs, is predominantly Pakistani Muslim men. Now, I hear them frequently referred to as Asian grooming gangs, but I know that that's not true. You know, they're not from Thailand. They're not
right.
Sikhs. They're not Hindus. They're not from Japan. You know, they are predominantly Pakistani Muslim men. So, I mean, even this last week, I've had an email from a Sikh man saying that that community are really upset that these gangs are referred to as Asians. So, but the authorities tiptoed around that fact. And I do think that was one of the reasons why this problem was allowed to evolve and go unchallenged for perhaps 20 years, if I'm honest. But my take on that always is that for me, this has always been about protecting children. And I don't care where an abuser comes from. You know, I don't care if it's Jeffrey Epstein or Harvey Weinstein or a priest in the Catholic Church. The law in this country says you cannot have, you know, 40, 50, 60-year-old man cannot get a child of 11, 12, 13 drunk out of their head and then have sex with them. That is rape. And the law says that is unlawful. So for me, it was simple. We had the evidence. I mean, even with Ruby, we had a fetus. We proved who had got her pregnant. Ruby had special educational needs. She had the mental capacity of a younger child. And she gave multiple interviews on video to me, naming multiple abusers. At the end of the road, even in relation to Ruby, that man was never charged with rape. He was charged with conspiracy. He was out of prison in less than 4 years. Ruby didn't know he hadn't been charged with rape. He was allowed to go back to Rochdale where these crimes were happening. And she bumped into him in the local supermarket, not even in knowing he was out of prison. So those things really made me angry, made me ashamed to be a police officer. And it was the second time I'd seen this happen. And I thought, you know, it made me very, very ill, actually, because I couldn't make any sense of it. You know, for me, it was simple. You had if you just simplify it to Ruby, because your listeners, I can't go into everything.
Sure.
It's really complicated. But I did write a book called Survivors. So if anybody really wants to understand the full complexities of it, it's all written down in there.
Mm. Well, briefly, should we just say roughly how many children were involved in this Rochdale grooming gangs?
Countless. But 2 weeks ago, there was an independent report published, which has taken 12 years to come out. I've worked with an independent review team for 6 years. That report, 2 weeks ago, officially found that there were almost 100 abusers, again, that there were in excess of, I think they said, 76 children. And yet, eventually, there was a trial built around one child. That, for me, is not justice. We had the evidence. We had the children. The official findings of that report was that Greater Manchester Police were not prepared to put resources into that investigation. And that was the same reasoning that was given about the 2005 job in the official report that reported in 2020. So both of those reports, I could have written 15, 20 years ago. Well, 15 years and 12 years ago, because there is nothing in those reports that I wasn't saying at the time. And in relation to the Rochdale case, my final day on that job, it was on a Friday afternoon, there was a meeting. The first time the barrister had been in to see us, I wasn't invited into that meeting. Now, Amber had, as I say, had just identified 10 of the first 12 of her abusers. She had put her life on the line for 8 months. We were delivering precisely what senior officers at Greater Manchester Police had asked me to do. And they came out of that meeting, and I was told by a colleague, have they said anything to you, Maggie? No. Right. Well, they're not going to use Amber anymore. Now, this was the second time I'd heard it, and this time I'd been given cast iron guarantees that if these kids told me and told the police what had happened to them, that they would be supported all the way through to trial. And here I am being told again, we've changed our mind. And I literally picked my bag up because I would have punched somebody. I was incandescent with rage. I was angry. I was incredulous. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I walked off that job and I never went back on it. Now, in relation to Amber, bear in mind the top lawyer in the CPS had decided that she was a victim. Even though she'd been arrested, before we were allowed to even go anywhere near her, they had officially designated her a victim. I left that job. I sat at home trying to think, what am I going to do? Because at that point, I honestly believed it was a lazy officer who wasn't doing the job. I was just so naive. I really, really thought, I never for one moment thought that the whole organisation, that the whole of police in the UK had made a conscious decision that this is how these cases would be dealt with. I mean, the last 12 years have been an education for me.
So what's behind this? Are we dealing with people who are sort of afraid of offending minorities, or are we dealing with potentially people who are friends with the bad people who are infiltrating the police?
Both those two official reports have said that the police dropped both those jobs because they would not put resources into it. So it was money. So it's about prioritising the resources within the police force. But I have no doubt that part of that was a judgment of these children, that they were from difficult backgrounds, that they were, I mean, how many times have you heard that these children were making a lifestyle choice, that they were complicit in their abuse? And my response to that is always, if this was the chief constable, or if it was Rishi Sunak's daughter, or, you know, the daughter of a wealthy individual, would the police still say that that child was making a lifestyle choice? And I would say absolutely not. But these children, I would say, were the most vulnerable in our country. You know, mostly on Augusta, those kids were all living in care homes. And I use that word care because that's how it's referred to. But those children are not cared for. They don't know love. They're not cared for. Nobody cares about them. And so when an abuser will target a vulnerable child, and they can spot vulnerability easily, they give that child attention. You know, they might take them out in a big car. They might buy them a pizza or a bit of jewellery, food. Those children initially feel important. They think that somebody cares about them. That is exploitation. And these gangs are so sophisticated because the authorities have never addressed it. So you know, and in the Rochdale case, those most of those children were living at home. But for instance, Ruby and Amber, their brother had been abused in the care home that Cyril Smith abused children in.
Right.
And the brother had actually met his abuser in the street. He was working for the post office many years later. And then he took a drug overdose, and Amber actually found him dead on the couch. Mum had a nervous breakdown. There were eight children. So they were like bringing themselves up. And it wasn't that they weren't cared for. They were living in a very difficult situation. And my take on it was, and still is, that the family should have been supported because they weren't bad people. They were just struggling. And the children were left to their own devices. So when somebody turns up and gives them some attention and a little bit of care, the children, you know, a 12-year-old child doesn't see that this is bad. Both of those children now can look back and they know full well. You know, when I'm with Ruby, because they're like my own children in many ways. I've, you know, been alongside them for 10, 12 years. But when I talk to Ruby now, I mean, she's got children that are almost the age that she was when she was being raped. And she can't understand now how that could be allowed to happen. I can't understand it.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
But with Amber, they dropped her as a victim. And I went off the job. I couldn't make any sense of it. I spent about 6 weeks trying to decide what I was going to do. But ultimately what was happening in the background, we had Hillsborough all over the telly.
Right.
And families that had lost 30 years of their lives trying to fight for the truth to come out.
For non-Brits, it's just that was a disaster at a soccer football stadium,
yeah,
where people were crushed and the police appeared to have covered up.
They blamed the families.
Yeah.
They said that the victims were drunk and right, they were fighting and it was their own fault that they had been squashed to death. And the families never accepted that. And for 30 years, they fought for the truth. And the truth has come out. There were decisions made by police and the authorities where gates were opened and that caused the stampede. That was all going on the TV back in 2011. And I'm sitting there in a real mess, couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, I couldn't make sense of, you know, here's a job that I'd given 16 years of my life to that I thought was about protecting children. There's nothing more important to me. And yet here I am for the second time seeing senior officers closing down a job where I knew again of dozens of men that were abusing children. And I've got four kids of my own, as I said, and I just thought, knowing the kind of person that I am, I always do my best. And I've got a very good sense of right and wrong. This wasn't about being a police officer. This was just so wrong that any decent human being who heard what was going on would think it was wrong. And from the police, for senior police officers, chief constables, to decide to close a job down when we had all the evidence we needed, for me was so wrong that if I didn't speak out about it, I was as bad as them. And I didn't want my kids to turn the telly on in 30 years' time when I'm not here. and hear all about Rochdale and Operation Augusta and say, well, my mum worked on that. Why did she not say anything? So ultimately, I spoke to the boss on that job and I told her what I thought was wrong. And she agreed with me. She said, you know, I agree with what you're saying, but I was only a detective. Senior officers make decisions and you do as you're told. And if you can't do that, maybe you're in the wrong job. Now, I'd been struggling about what to do because I felt great loyalty to that officer because she was completely out of her depth. She'd been put on that job to run it. She didn't have a clue. She'd never run a serious investigation. She couldn't open the computer system. She was out of her depth, but she wasn't a bad person. But when she said that to me, I thought, you know what? My loyalties have to be to these children. If you know what is going on and you are not saying anything, then who else is going to? So that was when I made my mind up that I was going to speak out. I was not going to be silenced. And I started about a 15-month journey within the police. I was still a serving police officer, and I went to everybody. I went to the head of public protection. I went to the chief constable, head of serious crime, the Home Office, the IOPC, a lawyer. Nobody wanted to hear what I had to say. The chief constable basically said he wouldn't meet me. I did him a War and Peace email, same one I sent to the head of public protection. Just didn't want to know. You know, if lessons have to be learned, we will learn them. Thank you very much for your interest. And the more I wrote to people, the more the penny began to drop. That whereas initially I thought they didn't know what was going on, I thought that I would shock them. When I said, if the public knew what was going on here, the organisation would be brought into disrepute. Do you know? Mm. I now know 100% that they all knew. I was the problem because I wouldn't be silenced. And the head of serious crime, when I was granted 10, 15 minutes of his time, he told me, I made it very clear that I was not going to be silenced, that if he didn't listen, if the police didn't act, I was going to go public. And he made it very clear that if I went public, you can go to prison. What you know is confidential. You only know it because you're a serving police officer. It's in writing. And so it terrified me, actually. But I still felt somewhere inside that if I didn't speak, nobody would. And I, once I'd faced my fear and stepped outside the organisation, I was on the outside. I was not going to be silenced. And I resigned in October 2012 and I went public. I spent 3 months putting a programme together with File on Four. Just before I resigned, though, I was told, I don't know why I was told, but somebody told me in a document that was very confidential, I was made aware that not only had Amber been dropped as a victim, when the barrister who was leading the trial found out exactly what Amber had told me and what she had disclosed, it became very clear that the trial would not go ahead without her evidence. And anybody who understands the criminal justice system will know that in a court of law, in a trial, the only evidence that is admissible is either if you are a victim or a witness, or you are an offender. And so the only way of getting Amber's evidence then into court, because she'd been dropped as a victim and it was too late to bring her back, was to secretly add her onto the indictment as an abuser. Oh. So they never told her.
Because of the accusations of her being a madam.
Yeah, so they portrayed her wrongly, and the report 2 weeks ago categorically says that was wrong. I knew it was wrong from day one. Anybody with any ounce of decency would know that was wrong, and that the police and that the Crown Prosecution Service would stoop to those depths secretly, and the reason was and I'm quoting, a tactical option to get her evidence into court. For me, is inhumane. It is wicked. It is the worst thing I have ever heard. So they secretly added her onto the indictment. They never arrested her. They never cautioned her. They never gave a legal representation. They didn't tell her. Oh. And all the evidence that she had shared with me as a victim in video interviews was then used in court to prosecute the abusers, but they added her onto that gang of abusers as one of the conspirators, even though she had been through exactly the same as all the other victims.
You must have felt, how did you feel?
Sick. I still do. Sick to my stomach. And I was, obviously I was told I couldn't speak to them.
Right, yeah. So you couldn't even explain it.
I couldn't even.
So they must have thought you'd betrayed them.
They were told that I'd lost the plot. That they were told they mustn't contact me, and I thought I'd abandoned them. So virtually the day after I resigned, I went back to that family. It was 15 months after I'd spoken to them. They wouldn't let me through the door because they thought I'd just, you know, I'd used them and I'd dragged them in. But they did let me in, and I explained what had happened. Oh. And I also explained to Amber, you were put on the indictment. Bear in mind, this is 6 months after the trial. And she just went white, and her mum, and then the penny dropped, and she said, "Oh my God, now it makes sense." She said she just had her first baby, and the baby was a second baby. The first baby she'd had just before I met her. Mm-hmm. Now she'd got a second baby that had been born about 2-3 weeks before I'd gone back. And when that baby was born, because she'd been named on the indictment as part of the grooming gang, as an abuser, before that baby was born, or when the baby was born, social services had turned up at the hospital and they had tagged the baby and they wouldn't let her take the baby out of the hospital. 3 days later, the matron said, "We need the paperwork to keep this baby here any longer." They didn't have any paperwork. It was an unlawful kind of imprisonment of her and her baby. It went to court, and they tried to take her kids away from her. But I went and got lawyers then, and we fought because it was all complete and utter lies. It took a year, but she kept her kids. I have no doubt that had I not gone back, they would have taken her kids away from it based on a pack of lies. And I have no doubt that she would have committed suicide. She is a great little mum. And I know I was ashamed of my part in gaining their trust, but I have done everything I could to put it right.
And it wasn't your fault.
It wasn't my fault.
You were made complicit without...
Yeah, no. It wasn't my fault, but I felt a real sense of responsibility. But I love them. I love them dearly. They're hard work.
You've saved their lives. You've saved their lives.
Well, they are. You know, they know my kids. I know their children. And we've travelled this journey together. And I have no doubt that without me standing up to be counted, they would have had their lives destroyed. Mm-hmm. This issue would have been buried because Augusta, nobody even knew that job had existed. So I lost everything though I resigned from the police. I lost my income. I lost my career. I lost my mental health for a long time. My last day at work, I was unconscious on the floor because I was so ill and I couldn't make sense of it. And I just wanted the truth to be told. So I did a documentary with File on 4 thinking that would be it, you know. The girls actually took part in that documentary, but the subject kind of wouldn't leave me alone. It followed me.
Yeah.
And then the drama team approached me and I ended up bringing on board everybody to make that drama. I was the program consultant. Then the drama is a drama, kind of doesn't tell the full truth. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a book because I wanted the facts to be there.
Yeah.
Not just a drama. I wanted the facts there. And then I thought I was completely worn out. We were like 8 years after I'd resigned then. And I thought, you know, I can't do this on my own anymore. So I either walk away completely or I try and build a team that can carry on this legacy alongside me and then carry on when I can't do it anymore. So I started my own charity, which was the Maggie Oliver Foundation. And that was in 2019. We've now helped over 4,000 survivors of abuse, and we are working on cases today with victims who are being failed today.
Wow.
The independent reviews, Andy Burnham, who's the Police and Crime Commissioner and the Mayor of Manchester, heard me spouting on the radio and on the TV after the drama. I'm sure he thought I was telling lies at the time, but he announced that there were going to be an independent review into the Manchester case and the Rochdale case. Both of those have officially concluded that I was telling the truth. Every single word I've said is the truth.
Vindicated.
I'm vindicated. And amazing. More than that, the world knows it's the truth. And although last week there was a press conference when that report was published, and if anybody wants to go onto my, say, Twitter, it's Maggie Oliver UK, I've shared that press conference, and I heard the new chief constable saying, his words were, as surely as night follows day, this wouldn't happen today. Well, I stood up and I said, it absolutely is happening today. And I'd been approached in the last month by an officer who is now resigned, who could have been me 10 years ago. So don't come with all that. This is going on.
Overconfidence every time that they have.
It's just, you know, pretending it's in the past. And my argument is, this isn't about the past. And unless you're honest about what is going on, you know, from the foundation, we are taking cases to throughout the whole country. We're a national charity, about police failures, about where victims are being fobbed off, about where they're being criminalised, where they're being arrested and silenced. You know, we are a real voice for change, but it's based on current practices and multiple victims who, I mean, I've been saying, because everybody in the UK has seen this drama, Mr. Bates against the post office. Yes, yeah. I could be Mr. Bates, because in the foundation, we are pulling together all these voices of isolated victims who are being treated in the same way. We are spotting patterns and failures, and I've got no axe to grind except do your job properly.
Yeah.
Your job is to uphold the law. If you have a victim comes to you who has been raped on a daily basis, or, and I don't just mean grooming gangs, I mean victims of any kind of sexual crime. So violence against women and girls, an individual rape, a young man being abused. We only deal with sexual crime, but so many are getting a horrific service from a system which is completely broken. You know, the complaint system is unfit for purpose. It is not independent.
Well, let me ask you, I've heard quite a lot that it's been said that they didn't want to offend the British Pakistani community.
Yeah.
And that was a big, because I know you mentioned the budgets and things, they didn't want to spend the money on the operations. But do you think there was an issue that they didn't want to offend?
I do think the ethnicity of the offenders, definitely back in 2005, and also, when I first started out, I couldn't refer to these abusers as Pakistani Muslim men. I remember going on the Today programme with John Humphreys and really being pushing the buttons or the boundaries, because it's the truth. It is the truth. But as I've said, that was definitely a big part of why the authorities tiptoed around it. I also believe that it is, as I've said, because these children were seen as an underclass, that they didn't matter, that who was going to, challenge the system, who's going to, fight for these kids. And if they did, they're so easy to dismiss.
This is a modern phenomenon whereby, this is just my opinion, but some people on the left have stopped caring about class and helping the working class. So they turned a blind eye to that and then started caring an inordinate amount about offending people, even if they might be abusers or whatever. I had Yasmin Mohammed on the show yesterday. She's an ex-Muslim who had a torrid childhood and difficult upbringing. She's fantastic, a wonderful speaker. And I told her I was speaking to you, and she knows the case. She's Canadian, but she knows about the case. And she said to say to you, and I'm sure you know as well, like, this is going on in Pakistan. She said this is being brought straight over here.
It has.
And those very men, she's not entirely sure about those particular men who were involved in that case in Rochdale, but often they will start there and they come over, and that's why it's so coordinated.
Yeah. I think there is a culture in the police that turns a blind eye. But I also feel within the Pakistani Muslim community that are involved in this kind of abuse, there is an attitude that the children they're abusing don't matter, that they are up for it, that they are, you know, they're not Muslim children, that they are seen as an underclass, and that there is a word for it. You know, they're out in, and they're, even in the trial, in the Rochdale trial, the main abuser was called Shabir Ahmed, or Daddy was his nickname. Oh. And even in the trial, he stood up and he blamed the children and the families for letting the children go out at night at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. Yeah. Well, you know...
Kafir, is that the word?
Yes, it is.
Kafir.
It is that they are... Now, there are good Pakistani Muslim people, many.
Many, yeah.
What I want to do is generate a conversation as to why does this happen? And without honesty about the fact that it is happening, and that it is so sophisticated now that the networks are really well developed. The children might be picked up in Rochdale, but they will be taken to Rotherham or Huddersfield or Birmingham, or it's all around the country. Why is that? And I would like to see the community itself begin to speak out very vocally that this is not acceptable. I mean, I'm no expert in religion. I'm not religious myself, but I do know that the Quran, depending on who you speak to, doesn't condone this, but others will say that it does. We are a multicultural country. And what, for me, it's very simple. If anybody comes to this country, they're entitled to their own religion, but they are not entitled to bring things that they may get away with in other countries to this country. Mm-hmm. We all abide by the same laws in the UK. And harsh as it might sound, if you're not prepared to do that, you don't live here. If I go to a different country, I have to respect their laws and their rules. You know, I spend quite a lot of time in Turkey, and they have different rules than we do here, but I would never expect to override their laws by taking what I have to, you know, what I believe from here.
Yeah, I saw a stat saying that although British Asians, and that's the word they've used, unfortunately, and you've pointed out why that's not right.
They should always be
Pakistani Muslims. But it's, you know, British Asians make up 7% of the population, but 87% of convictions involving child exploitation involved British Asians. So, but they said, this was a commissioner report, you probably actually saw this at the time, to dwell on this data would be irresponsible.
And I categorically disagree with that. I would say that figure that you've said is actually double what it should be, because half of those people in that percentage are women.
British Asian. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you would halve that.
So 3% of the population are British Asian men.
Yes. And they are responsible.
87%.
At least 87%, because I know there was an organisation, I can't Quilliam Foundation, I think it was. But you have to halve those.
Wow.
And the authorities have never collected ethnicity of the offenders. And in the foundation, we now do. But we, you know, we're not a national statistical authority. But I would argue that the statistics are not collected because they would very clearly prove what you've just said. What I would say, and I always say it, that we are, the vast majority of people in this country are white British people. And I am not saying, and a great deal of the abuse in this country is carried out often within the family. But if you look at this particular kind of crime, which hasn't been addressed properly by the authorities, it is indisputable, in my opinion, that that is the makeup of the offenders. And I want to see a national conversation about it, an honest one. And I want to know reasons why we don't address it. And we have to.
You know what it reminds me of? I don't know if you were aware of at the time, or maybe you were on this particular thing, but there was a Channel 4 documentary about 20 years ago that looked into the mosques around Britain and the hate speech, basically calling for the deaths of Jews and homosexuals and anyone who was kafir, that kind of thing, calling very aggressively for that, which is, I believe, illegal, that kind of trying to rally people up to murder others. And when that was brought to the attention of the police, I think, tried to sue Channel 4, or at least were criticised Channel 4 for releasing the documentary because they said it would interfere with relations in the community.
I wonder if it... When I started out on this journey in 2004, it might be the same documentary you're talking about, but there was a documentary on Channel 4 and it was part of the Dispatches programme.
Right.
And it was called Edge of the City.
Might be that.
And a documentary team were shadowing a social services team in Keighley in South Yorkshire. And as part of that, it was for many months, and as part of that documentary, they discovered this particular problem that the community had been fighting to have this addressed by the police. Anne Cryer was the MP for Keighley. She brought it up in Parliament and nobody wanted to hear about it. Now, when I joined Operation Augusta in 2004, I know the reason that investigation was put together was because we had had a little girl called Victoria Agolia, who had been horrendously sexually exploited and abused in Rochdale. And she was given a drugs overdose by one of her main abusers. At exactly the time that that death occurred, that documentary, Edge of the City, was due to go out, to be transmitted. And it was also when the elections were going on. And so the police, I think it was the police, applied to have that episode held back because they feared it would cause racial tension and riots. So that episode was held back, or that program was held back. Victoria died, who had been through exactly what the children in Keighley were going through. I know the Greater Manchester Police feared that there would be an outcry when this program went out. That's why they put together Operation Augusta. I was asked to go on that job. There were only three of us to start with, and it grew into a bigger job. But when the programme was finally transmitted and there wasn't a national outcry, they thought, well, why are we going to take this job any further? So they buried that job. They forgot about all the children. They allowed 100 abusers to continue to abuse and pretended that that job had never happened. Now Greater Manchester Police in 2020 have been forced to reopen that case, but it's 20 years too late.
Yeah.
So those reasons that you're saying, I have no doubt at all, were the thinking behind, I always call it willful blindness. They knew what was going on. They chose to do nothing for the reasons you said, but also why put money into these cases when we really don't want to know what's going on? Let's pretend it doesn't happen. But the losers were the kids.
Yeah.
And the men that were abusing still were allowed to continue to abuse for 15 years. God knows how many other kids they abused. So we need a national conversation. Also in 2008, I am told, it was actually the former chief prosecutor who said that in 2008, the government sent a circular around to all the CPS offices saying that these kind of crimes must not be investigated by the police. So there are all these reasons threading into it. So for me to be heard has been the biggest battle of my life. I was speaking the truth, and now I think that truth is accepted throughout the country to the point that people don't really talk about it anymore because people know that that is the truth.
Are there right now, in and around Britain, are there right now British Pakistani gangs exploiting children?
Absolutely, 100%. But what I want to make very clear is that for me, this issue has moved way beyond just the grooming gangs. For me, this is about systemic failures within the police, within the criminal justice system, which is on its knees. It is a lack of victim care. It is blaming victims and silencing them, whoever their abusers are. I mean, there's going to be another review coming out in probably within the next 6 weeks in relation to victims who have been unlawfully, inhumanely strip searched in police custody. Yes. They're being, I call them punishment strip searches, because we were supporting four of those victims, now eight that we've identified. All of them have dared to challenge Greater Manchester Police in the way they've been treated.
I spoke with one of them. I can't think of her name, but she was sort of almost...
Zainer.
Yes.
Yes. Well,
she was knocked out and then woke up.
That's
and
right.
Found she'd
she's
been
one of them.
Stripped.
So Zainer's one of the girls who... I mean, she's a very strong character herself,
yes.
But she came to the foundation. I know Zainer. She's one of, I think there's 13, but Zainer was one victim. Within the foundation, we spotted a pattern. And so we actually took it to Sky. And Sky did a really good, thorough piece covering... four of those victims that we are fighting for three of them. Zainer's kind of fighting her own battle, but she's still, we were messaging last week, but many victims don't feel strong enough to take the system on. And I say about the post office drama, you know, each one of those victims, the postmasters who were sent to prison or criminalised, as an individual, their voice becomes buried. They are very easy to be dismissed. But once you go from 1 to 2 to 10 to 20, suddenly this isn't a mistake. It isn't one victim who is, you know, easy to blame. It becomes an example of a pattern of behaviour. And that's the value of the Maggie Oliver Foundation, that we are able to plot the patterns. So I would say an unlawful use of strip searching as a means of silencing victims who are challenging a system that doesn't want to be challenged. Abuse of power within that system. Absolutely no independent scrutiny of those actions of police forces, because when a victim complains to the police, it is investigated by their own professional standards department. And even when they take it to the next level and go to the independent office for police conduct, they are not independent and they don't see that complaint. The form goes online, addressed to the IOPC, but they don't open it. It goes straight back to the professional standards within the police force against who the complaint is. And it's only when that police force voluntarily refers it to the IOPC that the IOPC ever see it. So I'm looking to change a system. If you had a system that worked, somebody like Amber or Ruby who complained would have somebody independent looking at their case and maybe would think, this isn't right. But when you're complaining to an organisation that has caused that problem, they do not want to see that they are corrupt or that they are acting unlawfully. And they cover up the system in exactly the same way as the post office covered up. It's power in the hands of those who are under investigation. It's an abuse of power. So I started this journey being horrified by the treatment. It was actually Amber that brought it to a head for me, and then Ruby. And the more I've travelled along this path, the more my eyes have been opened to the fact it wasn't one lazy officer and it wasn't one case that wasn't handled properly. And it actually wasn't just about the ethnicity of offenders or the social class of the victims. It is a system that needs to be fit for purpose. And if there is something going wrong, we need to have somewhere to go to expose what's going wrong, because I had nowhere to go. I was telling the truth. I tried desperately to be heard. And yet, where could I go? I went within the organization trying to get a chief constable to listen to me. And you know what he said when I went public? He went on national TV and radio. He knew what I was saying was true. And yet he said I was a woman who became too emotionally involved. I had been bereaved. I had lost the plot. He'd met me on many occasions. To this day, he's never met me once. But I had nowhere to go. He was a liar. His name was Peter Fahey. He is now Sir Peter Fahey. And he's a victim's advocate in the media. And I'm sorry, he should be in prison. The chief prosecutor, Nazir Afzal, he's the one who decided to drop Amber as a victim and then authorised her to be added onto the indictment as one of the offenders. For me, he was complicit in that behaviour.
He's got, forgive me for saying it, he's got an unfortunate sounding name to be dealing with child exploitation. Peter Fahey. Peter Fahey?
Peter Fahey.
Sounds like
Peter Fahey. Oh, I never thought of that,
yeah,
possibly.
Unfortunately.
But I've heard him on the radio. I get really triggered by this.
I bet. Well, he's lied about you.
He lied. But it's not just about me. I mean, I hear him on the radio saying that he's a good Christian. He's got three daughters of his own. And I think, what about all these children? In your hands was their welfare, and you were in a position of power. You were the chief constable, and you turned away from them. And now you're pretending to care about victims. Well, I'm sorry. If you cared about victims, you would not have allowed this to happen on your watch. You would have stood up and been counted alongside me, and you weren't. So I get really angry when somebody like that is made, you know, is knighted. He should be in prison. And actually, Nazir Afzal, you know, they're on the media, on BBC, everywhere, all the time, talking about the rights of victims. Well, I'm sorry, the hypocrites, when they were in a position where they could have done something, they did nothing. Instead, it was shoot the messenger. I was the messenger. I was telling the truth. And I tried my absolute best. I went to him, begging and pleading for him to do something about these kids. And he turned away. And for me, that is unforgivable. And I've got over it. You know, it strengthened me. I'm a lot different than I was. It's changed me forever. But I call a spade now. I don't like conflict. I never have. But I became the voice of those who had no voice.
How can people help now? Go to the Maggie Oliver Foundation.
Go to our website, themaggieoliverfoundation.com. If they're doing, yes, please. If they're looking for a charity to support, you know, we exist purely on public donations and trust funding. We get not a penny from the state, because I want to be able to speak the truth, not have it connected to, you know, saying the right thing, or we're not going to give you your funding. If we fall apart and we're not able to operate anymore, then so be it. But now I've gone from me, I've got 5 members of staff, 30 volunteer ambassadors. We've got 40 people in our team now.
Amazing.
And we are building an army. So please support us. Go to my Twitter, my LinkedIn.
Yeah, put the Twitter in the description as well.
Yeah, I'm on Instagram. I try and keep that a little bit less serious, but sure. My Twitter is, I pretty much share a lot of.
We'll pop it all in there.
Thank you.
Description. You just email me what you want. We'll pop it in there. Tell me quickly now, who is a heretic you admire?
I don't know whether I would call her a heretic. And I guess it's always going to be controversial. But my inspiration in many ways has been Princess Diana. You know, I can identify with her, that the establishment tried to destroy her. You know, they tried to write her off as a woman who had, you got mental health problems. And I think that she was treated really badly. She was really little more than a child. I believe she absolutely idolized Prince Charles, but I think she was, you know, chosen to give birth to children, and then she was cast aside. But I think that the country saw that she'd risen above that, and she did a lot of good things. And so for me, I guess it would be Princess Diana.
Oh.
I don't know if she's a heretic.
Sure.
But she definitely is, was inspirational for me, and set herself against, she was set against the establishment, and they tried to destroy her, and yet she rose above it and recreated what I felt was a good person. So I guess that's who I would choose.
Thank you, Maggie, Oliver. What a pleasure it was to be able to interview her, she. Amazing. I'm really, really happy I got to do it. Got to do it in person, no less, which was fantastic. Do go check out the YouTube version, by the way, if you want to see the beautiful, beautiful setting that we got to record this in. And I'm wearing a nice velvet green jacket, which is something. We did an extra bit over on Locals. That's andrewgold.locals.com. You should get that on Patreon and on Apple subscribers as well. And share this podcast around. That's all I've got to say. I'm struggling not to cough. I'm trying so hard not to cough. It's been months now. I'm sure you're all very concerned about me, but I do think it's just a cough. It's just one of those coughs, isn't it? You can't do much about that. But I've managed to get through the whole thing without doing so, and I will see you next time.